We're here tonight, I want to remind everybody, another Jessica Catto dialogue, thanks to and in the memory of and vision, environmental vision of Jessica Hobby Catto. And I know her daughter and her son-in-law, Daniel and Issa. Can we say hi, Daniel, right here, are here tonight? And Duncan and Fiona as well. Thank you all for coming. For almost 50 years, Aspen Center for Environmental Studies has been working on ecology, science education, sustainable agriculture, forest health, and now civic leadership as well. Our speaker tonight, I'll introduce in a moment, but this is a subject that hits really close to my heart. I first learned about the disaster of plastics pollution in 2000 when National Geographic, and maybe some of you guys remember this, published the photos of those albatrosses on Midway Atoll that were all starved to death. And they starved to death. Their stomachs were full, but they starved to death on plastic. And then in 2009, the documentary Tapped, if anybody saw that, on the water bottle, the environmental impacts of the bottled water industry. I'll never forget in that documentary seeing this beach south of San Diego, and the camera pans out to this amazing, beautiful beach, and it slowly zooms in, and you see some guy with a shovel lifting up this beautiful sand, and the camera zooms in on the sand, and as it zooms in, you look and notice that the sand is actually about 50% tiny particles of plastic, and this is in our country. And we think we're pretty progressive here in Aspen. We have a grocery sack, plastic grocery bags you have to pay a fee for. Basalt in my community, we tried to pass one of those, it failed. I was rafting the Roaring Fork River last weekend. We pulled to the side of the river, and there was a plastic ball and a fertilizer bag, an empty fertilizer bag. And this is in our pristine Roaring Fork River. And I was talking to our speaker today at lunch, and this blew my mind when he said this to me. He said, you know, I said, we're so far from the problem, 2,000 miles, because the ocean's so far away. And he said, no. He said, all the fleece you guys are going to wash in your washer or dryer tonight, the little tiny microparticles that come out of plastic that come off that, will eventually be in a fish in the Pacific Ocean. Now, of course, that would be if our river reached the Pacific Ocean, and it doesn't, sadly. But our speaker tonight, I'm so proud to have here. He's a research director and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute. He studies global distribution and ecological impacts of marine pollution. He recently published the first, and this is when you get someone who's done a first, it's incredible. The first estimate of all the floating plastic on Earth, 270,000 metric tons, 5.25 trillion pieces of plastic in our oceans. And I'm looking at my son in the back, Zealand, that's the world we've left you, 5 trillion pieces of plastic in your ocean. In 2013, our speaker and his colleagues, he received his PhD from University of Southern California in 2003. Months after that, he embarked on a 2,000-mile journey down the Mississippi River. He did a journey from California to Hawaii on a raft made out of plastics, bringing attention to the issue. And you can get his book outside as well. And his first book was My River Home. His next book's out there that you can purchase. Please join me in welcoming Marcus Erickson. Thank you, Marcus, for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Well, good evening, and thank you for coming out tonight to hear a lot of about trash. We're going to talk trash for an hour. I want to thank ACES for inviting me out this evening. It actually began with meeting Glenn Buxbaum, the Baum Foundation, last year, and he brought us together, and now we're here. I'm going to take you on a journey of around the world to look at the impact of our consumer culture. And I'm going to talk about some of the impacts, the global distribution of trash, what we study at the Five Gyres Institute, and what my wife and I have done. We began this organization 9 years ago, and what we have found, and not just the problem, and it's going to be a little doom and gloom for a little while, but then what the solutions are, what we can do, and how everyone, as far from the ocean as you might live, are responsible and can solve this problem. So if we look at where this began, let's go back in time. Back in 1955, this is a Life magazine article called Throwaway Living. If I can remember the first sentence, I think it said, all the articles you see being thrown in the air, no housewife need bother washing, strange sign of the times, it's all meant to be thrown away. And that was our post-World War II culture of convenience that was just starting. And it really picked up in the 70s when everyone had a bag and a bottle and a straw. All those things became plastic all of a sudden. Well, if we look at these ads in the 1950s when plastic was coming around, are really amusing. What's the ad here? Like we're trying to keep our babies fresh? Not quite sure. That doesn't gross you out, how about the double? It gets worse. The triple. And the one baby trying to poke a hole in the saran wrap filling. So if we look at the growth of plastics over this time, since the 50s, it began with almost nothing in 1950 when we were first introduced to those materials. And if you were a kid back then, you know there was just no plastic around. Maybe an old telephone or Bakelite jewelry may have had that around. But no consumer plastics were really available. Well, it's spiked in the last 50 years. It's this 4-6% growth rate. And the industries that make plastic are looking for this to continue to rise over time as the middle class grows and population begins to climb. But those things will begin to plateau by mid-century. We're going to talk about this great divide between what environmental NGOs want and what industry plans to do. Well, if you look at that throwaway living today, here's how it looks today. So you had this flood of the single-use packaging that really came onto market in the 70s. Like I said, bottles, bags, and straws, and there are dozens of others that hit that list that of the single-use throwaways that became plastic. At the same time, globalization was happening. So it's a flood of convenience of materials and packaging sent to countries that really don't have the infrastructure or can afford the infrastructure to deal with it as we can here in the U.S., to the best of our ability here. So this issue has grown, but our contribution, what Ann and I set out to do, in 2008, what we saw was a lot of work or a lot of science being done in the Pacific. Captain Charles Moore had described the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Have you heard of that? So we're going to bust that myth tonight as well. But we saw that there was not much known about the Western Pacific or the Eastern Atlantic or anything south of the equator. So we began the Five Gyres Institute. And gyres are these circular currents that fill the big ocean basins above and below the equator. So North Pacific, South Pacific, North Atlantic, South Atlantic, Indian Ocean. They're clockwise in the Northern Hemisphere, counterclockwise below. A plastic bottle leaving California will be off Japan's coast in 3 to 5 years. Then it comes back, but it doesn't make landfall. So our global expeditions, our first expedition, we knew that, okay, we don't have a boat, but we can build one. So Anna and I, we were actually on the voyage of Captain Charles Moore crossing the Pacific Ocean in 2008, and I knew she was the one. So I fished out some fishing line out of the ocean, made a ring, real fancy stuff, and I caught her sleeping in the sails, and I proposed. And then I said, but, which probably you shouldn't do when you ask someone to marry you, I want to build this raft. So we talked about building this big boat. So we landed in Los Angeles, Hawaii to LA on that trip in 2008, and we had decided to build a boat, a raft, a homemade raft, 15,000 plastic bottles. We took 24 broken sailboat masts. Our other sailor, Joel Pascal, he was my co-navigator. Anna was land-based control on the satellite phone all the time, giving us wet weather updates. And so we took 24, 25 sailboat masts, made like a Polynesian deck, put the plastic bottles in fishing nets under that, then on top for a cabin, we chose a Cessna 310 aircraft. No motor, no chase boat. We saw it was a pile of junk, so we gave it that name. And we were towed about 60 miles offshore. And that began this amazing voyage. I don't recommend it unless you've got time. We made a lot of videos and documented our experience. I want to show you a little short video. It's a few minutes long. It's four little short videos about that experience at sea. And it shows, the first video actually is kind of funny. It wasn't at the time. It's about running out of food and all of our canned goods getting wet. Our boat actually sank about a foot in the water overnight after our first big storm. There was one little girl when we were building the boat had told me, aren't you going to glue the caps back on? Which I didn't do. And there was water leaking into all the bottles. And that's actually when I called Anna and I said, hey, babe, we're sinking. That's the first line in the book that's on the table outside. And she organized a dive boat. And I said, I need like a lot of glue, buckets of glue. I need more beer. I need some more vegetables and more cereal. So I had a long laundry list. And she met us at sea. We spent about 12 hours that day with a bunch of volunteers, pulling out bottles, gluing the caps back on, putting them back. And I spent the next 2 months doing that with Joel, my co-navigator. Every morning, pull out some bottles, pour out the water, put the bottle back in to stay afloat. But this first video is about all of our canned goods getting wet and the labels washing off, playing mystery meal. So you'll be amused, I hope.
The ocean stripped all the labels off our cans. They got rusted. Now we got to eat them. It's all beans and corn and peas.
Okay, come on, corn. Give me 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 corn. Corn. Beans.
One more?
Yeah.
Hey, let's see what it is.
We have the best. Let's go for the best before. More beans.
No wind.
We're completely becalmed today. It's no wind whatsoever. So we're just gonna fish and eat.
Hey, fishy, 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 fishy. Oh, there he is. Right there. Munch.
We are now skirting the edge of the North Pacific Gyre, roughly 1,000 miles east of Hawaii. We're finding lots of plastic on the surface of the ocean.
It's mostly small fragments, blue, green, white, and black, among many different kinds of zooplankton. Everywhere you go in the North Pacific Ocean, we find plastic.
So I filleted this fish, thinking I'm going to eat it, and here's what I found. It's full of plastic. This is the whole reason that we're out here, to bring this to your attention. The plastic isn't benign. The fish won't pass it. The plastic is full of persistent organic pollutants, things like PCBs, DDT, PAHs, things that are known human carcinogens and endocrine disruptors, things you don't want in your body, but they're in the fish that we eat.
I don't want plastic in my sushi.
We had planned on 5 to 6 weeks at sea, and 13 weeks later, we hobbled into Waikiki. But the most important photograph and experience was this observation, because this told us, and we told the world that, you know, everywhere you go in the world, you're going to find these microplastics. All that trash leaving land, this constant exodus of junk leaving our rivers, the world's rivers, is shredding into microplastic particles. Because when we do our research in the middle of the ocean, we mostly find the big stuff is mostly just fishing gear, the stuff designed to last forever. So there is this microplastic, these clouds of microplastics. So what we did, we realized, okay, we have to answer the first question, which is, where's the trash and how much is out there? So our global expeditions began. We began leasing vessels, and our first question we'd ask is, how many seats are available on these vessels we're leasing? And then we divide the charter by the number of seats. And that worked as a business model. And we've now run about 20 expeditions. Over 200 people have joined us. They've all become our close friends. There's nothing like being 3 weeks at sea if you're crossing an ocean from a continent to a continent to make good friends. For example, in this expedition here, we had this. You can see Jack Johnson there. That was our tour a couple of years ago. We've had CEOs of companies. We have had artists and educators, activists. We've had lots of sailors and scientists all come to do original work. It's been an amazing experience. But in doing that, going to each of these five subtropical gyres, let me back up, we began to see the same thing. So each of those dots you see is where we have been to drag that net, a 60-centimeter wide net, dragged for 2 or 3 miles at a time. We count the particles in the net, and we figure out, we extrapolate how many particles per square kilometer. We scale it up, and that becomes one data point that feeds our oceanographic models. The shipping industry knows really well where currents go in the world to optimize shipping. Using that data, we can then create our models. The orange and red, that's where we think trash is, and our data informs the model. And with that, we're able to make some estimates. So our samples, they kind of all looked like this. In each of the five subtropical gyres, we're finding handfuls of microplastic. In the thickest part, you might get a handful. Typically, it's one teaspoon for sieving in areas big as a football field. There are no islands of trash out there. That was our first big discovery. This media sensationalism had exaggerated the problem in one way, but not telling the real story, that it's impossible to clean up with nets, that prevention is the key. But I want to show you one more video, and this is our first expedition in the North Atlantic back in 2010 when we launched. What a gyre looks like.
Let's bring it in.
Lots of larval fish, sargassum, and little plastic particles. Yeah, look down here. Look at that. We're in the middle of the North Atlantic Gyre, also called the Sargasso Sea. It's called the Sargasso Sea because of sargassum. It's a kind of seaweed that filled our nets, but it's also full of small particles of plastic. What you got, Anna?
I see one.
It's a mouthpiece, I think, for a boxer. It's got some barnacles, some sargassum. This is 45 minutes of scooping through another windrow in the middle of the Sargasso Sea. I think we found the Atlantic garbage patch.
Ten degrees to port, Clive, about 100 meters. Dun, dun, dun.
You know how gross that is?
And that's why I married her. And there she is in the very back row with our 4.5-year-old daughter, 4 3/4, sorry, darling. This is what the garbage patch looks like. But we've stopped using the word patch, and I'll explain why in a moment. This is sieving roughly, like I said, a football field of area. We drag our net for about 2 or 3 miles, pull it up, and you get like a teaspoon, a couple of teaspoons of this plastic confetti. All the bits of film, like from plastic bags and chip wrappers and small sachet packets, we don't find that. It shreds very quickly. In the middle of the ocean, we don't see film, we don't see styrofoam. But our coastal surveys, it's there. It's not making out to the middle. What you see are hardened fragments, a kaleidoscope of this confetti of trash, right at the surface where a lot of life is as well. This will be at the table where we have books after my presentation. So we went to each of the five subtropical gyres, and we found the same thing, mostly microplastic particles in all five of them. And our next Our research, what we did, we took all that data, informed the model, and then published the first estimate of all plastics, all sizes, in all oceans. And that's the big number. 250,000 tons from 5.25 trillion particles. And it's not just in the gyres. It's upstream. It's in our bays and our lakes and rivers we discovered. But this was the first estimate. That's our baseline. So we're going to publish a new estimate in the next year or so to see how things have changed and keep this going far into the future. But one interesting observation, counterintuitive, of all that trash we found, divided into four size categories, the bottom right side, that's the big beach ball size, the big, big things we'd see, mostly fishing gear, 75%, about 80%. The bottom left, those are like water bottle size things, lots of detergent bottles we find out there and bits of rope, small bits of rope. In the top right side, those are lentil-sized fragments. On the left side, salt and pepper-sized fragments. The salt and pepper-sized fragments is 100 times less than we expected. The ocean surface isn't hanging on to this trash. Something is happening there. Now, we know that the first 100 meters of the ocean surface worldwide gets filtered through marine life completely every 3 months. There's so much biomass filtering water, taking stuff out. What I think is happening, either currents are beaching it on shore, and we find lots of microplastics and trash on beaches everywhere we look, or it's being filtered out and sinking to the seafloor in the bodies or the fecal pellets of organisms ingesting it. And our experience last summer, went to the Arctic, just last summer, and we were using a new thing, a new pump mechanism to get to the really, really small stuff, like the dust-sized fragments. What we found, and this is a slide from Vancouver Aquarium, who is also on the same ship, is that at the surface and subsurface, there are clouds of microfibers from fleece, from textiles, and microplastic particles that are getting into even the most remote waters on the planet. So we thought, how to reframe this? This is not a garbage patch. It's something different. And what makes sense to most people is the idea we understand what a smog is. A plastic smog. In the 1970s, when there was smog over our skies, we dealt with that. We knew, okay, I'm not going to remove all the particles of smog, and a vacuum cleaner is not going to suck up this mess. We knew it was prevention. And you saw catalytic converters on cars. You saw scrubbers on coal-burning power plants. We saw prevention, stopping it as far upstream as possible. And that's what it's going to take. So I urge you to change that metaphor from a patch to a smog. And that makes us think, okay, prevention is the key. So where's it coming from? People say, okay, it's shredding fishing nets. Oh no, it's ships that are polluting. Most of it comes from rivers. And around the world we're seeing, you know, varying degrees, every river I've been to, anywhere in Europe, in the developed world, the United States, or the parts of the planet, are pumping out trash. So if we use that smog analogy, you can think of our rivers and effluent pipes as those horizontal smokestacks feeding that plastic smog in our seas. So it comes from, one is poor waste management. And that's a problem worldwide. Globalization has moved stuff to the planet, but it hasn't exported ways to deal with the waste. One thing I noticed in our 2015 expedition from Miami to New York, we were sampling all throughout the gyre in the Atlantic. Our very last sample, right in the shadow of Manhattan, had more plastic by weight and count than all the previous 37 trawls we had did in the Atlantic. And it was all from sewage discharge, combined sewage overflow, which happens in the Northeast. It's pretty common. But then also, we noticed that around our communities, there's a constant flood of microplastics from all these activities, from shredding tires on highways, plastic bags, shredding in trees from ultraviolet light degradation. Those little guns, I hate these little guns, these little plastic BBs. Have you seen those? I've seen those in three of the world's gyres in my nets. If you want to design something to last, make it round and solid plastic, and it'll be there forever, floating around. And fibers from all kinds of textiles, from carpeting to clothing to tarps. There was one study looking at, okay, which rivers then is it? If it's mostly land, where's it coming from? Majority is Southeast Asia. And we've seen a lot of fingers point to Southeast Asia lately. And I kind of think it's unfair. It is coming from those parts of the world. There's not much waste management. But there's an import of trash going to Southeast Asia. Trash is a commodity. The West Coast of the United States, I can tell you, most of the MRFs that we talk to recycle centers, they say, you know, there aren't many markets for recycled plastic because virgin pellets are so much cheaper. So most MRFs say, I've got a choice. Either I pay a tipping fee in a landfill, like $60, or put it in a shipping container for free going back to China. That's where a lot of it goes. So a lot of U.S. waste is going overseas. But it's hard to point fingers without pointing fingers at everyone in our global culture of consumption. So we did all this ocean work, and you see the sample there. I have no idea what product those came from, or what country. We're finding those in international waters. So from a campaign perspective, trying to work with companies and countries and create some fair policies that level the playing field for all companies, it's impossible with that. But going upstream, and in 2013 we did that. Aboard the flagship Niagara, went up to the Great Lakes, went to all five Great Lakes, and what we saw, interesting, I'm stuck for a second here. Here we go. That's what we saw. It looked just like our ocean samples, but we had these very weird little perfectly round spheres that were blue and green and purple and red. And we thought, we had a hunch where these come from. Went to the local pharmacy, and we got products like Neutrogena. There's one called Clean and Clear is the product. I forget who makes it. Johnson & Johnson, some Procter & Gamble face scrubs. All these brands of face scrubs were using hundreds of thousands of particles of plastic in the scrubs as an abrasive. So we launched a big campaign. We had easily 50 environmental NGOs across the United States. We had politicians on board. We had the public. We had great videos and media assets. Our campaign, it was focused. And the focus was, this is a really dumb application of plastic. I'm not anti-plastic. I mean, the shoes I'm wearing, the textiles I have, the car that I drive, there are synthetic polymers and all that, and it makes cars lightweight. Airbags are synthetic. Hospital equipment, safety equipment. The space shuttles have plastic. But a single-use throwaway product, and this, that's designed to go down the drain out to sea, is the wrong application. Not the material, it's how we're using it. So our campaign worked. In late 2015, we went from discovery to publication to President Obama signing the Microbead Free Waters Act. And it goes into effect next month. It's our biggest win. And it shows the power of working together. It was easily, again, 50 environmental NGOs with the same message. So what's the impact? What does it matter, all this trash in the ocean? If it's going to sink eventually, does it make a difference? Before it sinks, it has impacts. So we can see that what's happening, it's degrading. Ultraviolet light is breaking it apart, photodegradation, mechanical degradation. There's some very low-level biodegradation. We have found microbes living in pits on the surface of bottles at sea. And we're not sure if those microbes made the pits or it's some other kind of degradation. Most of the bottles I see out to sea have little bite marks. Now, I was able to match the fish for the first time. If you're in the Atlantic, you see triggerfish out there. They have this really attractive overbite. And they use their front teeth to bite on the plastic while their lower teeth shaves off a little triangular bit. So we looked at all the different bite marks. I just published this a few months ago. We saw there are turtle bites, different kinds of triggerfish. We do find occasional shark bites as well. So we know that animals are eviscerating plastics. So some would become that plastic smog, and some's going to wash up ashore. Lots of shoreline deposition. Most beaches, the windward side especially, if you're a sailor, you've seen trash at sea, I'm sure, and hopefully not caught in your prop. And the deep sea. We're seeing more and more evidence of this thin layer of microplastics on the seafloor globally, on beaches, to the point that we call the fossil that represents our moment in geologic time is plastic. That's our index fossil that defines the Anthropocene. But some of the other impacts we've seen, when I first began 10 years ago, we would say there was 262 species impacted by plastics. That was the data then. Now it's over 1,200 species, billions of organisms. And it's not just in the middle of the ocean. So I'm a Gulf War veteran. 25 years ago, I was one of those Marines in Kuwait, covered in drops of oil. And I went back there last year for the first time on a very different mission to sample the Gulf of Arabia. I went back to Kuwait, actually found our old camp just outside Kuwait City. But I went further south. I went to Oman, Qatar, and Dubai. In Dubai, I met a veterinarian, and he's Dr. Uli Werner. And he knows Sheikh Mohammed really well. And the Sheikh said, I want the best camel hospital on the planet. And he got it. $50 million to build this amazing hospital. And I'm there with him, and I'm looking around. And he says, you know, if you want to see impact of plastics, yes, there's some in the Gulf of Arabia, but come with me. We went 60 miles inland. Beautiful rolling red sand dunes. And we walk out onto these dunes. And we're on top of one. I'm looking at this beautiful desert. There are a few piles of white here and there. And they were the bones of camels that had died. And that's natural. In the desert, you'll find these piles of white bones. We walk down to one. And he pulls a rib out of the ground and says, here. And then he grabs one. Let's dig. And we started digging up this camel in the middle of nowhere, inside the rib cage. We're getting down into the body. I can see the inside of the vertebrae, and then I see something else. So this is a mass of plastic bags and rope. It's the smallest one I've got. I've got five of these things. I've got one that's about 45 pounds, as big as a small garbage can. It's currently in Norway, the museum in Oslo. He said 15 years ago he began seeing plastic bags in camels. And if you're a rancher, maybe you've seen plastic bags inside your cows and horses. In India, they're inside goats all the time. There are even some organizations dedicated to keeping plastic bags out of cows across India. And he said it kills them in three ways. He's now seeing camels come to the hospital lethargic and emaciated. He said it's causing blockages in their guts. It toxifies them because of the leakage from the bags themselves. And it gives them a false sense of satiation, where they stop eating and stop drinking because they feel they're full with a body full of plastic bags that aren't passing through their bodies. They're residing in their gut. So again, it's a land and sea issue. And it impacts us as well. One paper recently suggested that if you eat shellfish, you're consuming an average of 11,000 microfibers in your consumption of shellfish. And you can see it's very simple. From our washing machines, fibers just are emitted by the tens of thousands per wash. And we're finding them again in all waters in the Arctic, as I showed you. And those come back in the foods that we eat. And in many organisms, many filter feeders are consuming small microplastics and microfibers, down to zooplankton, as you can see. So when we look at ecological impacts now, we're looking at there's the subcellular level, the cellular, individual, and the population impacts. And where the science is now, we're doing more and more of this work, but a lot is looking at are there significant population level impacts? Are we seeing species being impacted? And there have been a few studies came out recently suggesting that, yes, there is impairment of, for example, there was one species of perch. They found the larvae are attracted to microplastics. There are some receptors on the plastic that attracts them by smell. They consume it, and there's an increased mortality in those larval fish. So the research now is looking at population-level impacts. Okay, that's the end of doom and gloom. Let's get ourselves out of this issue. What we're seeing, and I'll tell you, I've just got back from two important conferences. One was the United Nations Oceans Conference. The UN has 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and this is their big, high priority. Goal 14 is ocean conservation, and a big part of that conversation was ocean plastics. And I was so impressed to see the science we were discovering and talking about 5 years ago are now at these high-level conversations. You're beginning to see some international commitments to reducing the amount of trash leaving coastal rivers. So, and as much as I've seen, I'm feeling optimistic. And I had a chance to join Glenn Buxbaum at Palmyra Atoll about 8 months ago, and I was sort of reinvigorated by seeing, you know, if we take a place And the Nature Conservancy, they own Palmyra. If we leave it alone, how resilient it can be, how nature can come back, we can stop the flow of trash out to sea. It was the most beautiful reef I've seen ever at Palmyra. What we're trying to achieve, what the world is talking about, the conversation is around circular economies. How can we get off of that linear economy? This is the circular flow, and there are two sides of it. There is the biological side, and that's using natural materials that will break down in the environment. And that's using paper and other materials. There are some bioplastics that seem promising in some applications. Then the technical cycle. If you're going to make something that doesn't fit the natural cycle, then you got to think in the design phase about the entire life cycle of that product. Do the systems exist to deal with that material when it becomes waste? When that laptop, that flat screen, that cell phone becomes waste, where does it go? Or that plastic bag, a bottle or straw? So I'm seeing this transition. And in some cases, some stakeholders have their heels dug in to keep the status quo as it's going. We're seeing the throwaway culture. There are some entities trying to hang on to that. It versus the circular design. You're seeing communities like Aspen are saying, okay, plastic bags doesn't fit. It's costing taxpayers too much to deal with that kind of waste management. And it makes things ugly. And it pollutes our space. You're seeing more of those. Reusables. I'm seeing in airports now, wherever I go, not just a water fountain to drink from, but also to fill your bottle. Couldn't those be in every bus stop, every subway across the country? You're seeing paper bags come back. Also, but more importantly, reusable bags. Has much less carbon footprint than paper or plastic. We're seeing also conversations, more of this, about waste cleanup. This is the trash wheel in Baltimore. You're seeing more of these structural controls that are capturing things at rivers. If you've heard any stories of big nets in the middle of the ocean that grab trash, science doesn't support it. For the best cost benefit, it's these river cleanup. I mean, there's these river controls. That's the last place to grab it. In the middle of the ocean, you might capture some fishing gear, and it makes more sense to incentivize fishermen to grab it. But on the other side, upstream sorting. We're seeing more communities are getting really good at sorting their compostables versus their recyclables, and the residuals, what doesn't fit in that circular economy, not a biological or technical material that has a good circular system, we're finding ways to reinvent those. Or get rid of them. And here's the big conversation. Waste to energy versus zero waste. And this is the biggest point of contention. And this is where the industries that make plastics and manufacture plastics do not want to let go. And when you look at their projections, and zero waste, by the way, it's working. In developing countries, we're seeing, like in Indonesia, Philippines, we're seeing more and more countries create these decentralized MRFs. A material recovery facility, a MRF, decentralized in that a village takes on the responsibility. And they go door to door. The former waste pickers are now door to door waste collectors. And they collect their compostables, the recyclables, and the residuals they put on display and say, this doesn't work in our community. We're seeing that really working. We're also seeing industry push for waste to energy. And I understand why. Going back to that graph of that production, to maintain that increased production, 4-6% per year, it's going to increase because of population growth and a rising middle class, but that's going to taper in time. And the only way to maintain that high level of demand for new plastics is if you get rid of last year's plastics through waste to energy. And you don't let recycling get good. And that's not conspiratorial thinking. That's looking at what's going to secure market demand. And I should talk a little more about that. So we see, you know, around the world, you have these circular economies that are forming and industry going in and really pushing for these energy recovery systems. And they're very expensive. What we're really pushing is for these decentralized MRFs to grow worldwide. What we're also doing here at Five Gyres, we are looking at, okay, in our country alone, looking at the U.S. alone, here we have relatively more efficient waste management systems. But still, You've got lots of trash on roadsides, in our streams, going down our biggest rivers. My experience on the Mississippi River, I saw an endless trail of trash. It's kind of how I got started on this issue in the first place. We created something called the Ban List, Better Alternatives Now. And our challenge was, okay, let's look at all the groups like Surf Rider, International Coastal Cleanup, River Keepers, all the mobile apps like Marina Debris Tracker, all the people collecting data sets about the trash that's on the land in our country. We got all those data sets, put them together, and we got this top 15 list of which are the kind of the kinds of products and packaging that are doing the most harm in our country, which are escaping some of the best waste management systems on the planet. The escape artists. And that's what they are. So this is where we think, these are the residuals, the things that really have no value. If they had value, you wouldn't see them on our roadsides. Aluminum cans, you don't see many of those. They've got this intrinsic value. These do not. So we kind of focus our efforts on those. So in our ban list, we took all those products and then thought, okay, where's the toxicity? What's the real harm? And what's the alternative? What's the other product, the other way of delivering that service that could work? So I urge you to go to Five Gyres and check out our ban list. It's a place for you to get involved, to see where you can have the most impact. So I'll wrap up with, you know, what can you do? What can you do today, this week, this month, to sort of usher in this age of conservation, which we had prior to World War II and during World War II with Victory Gardens, conserving materials, the post-World War II culture of consumption, to reel that in and become a culture of conservation? A few things. One big thing you can do, it's an easy lift, is to zero waste your grocery haul. If you could think in terms of when you go to the grocery, you're not just buying the product, but you're buying the packaging. And what's the full life cycle? Is your community really recycling that? And what's the true path, those recyclables? Are they going to China? Is that the ultimate fate of what we collect for recycling? Or to a landfill because it's cheaper there? So I think zero wasting your grocery haul is one of the first big, wonderful things you could do. Then zero waste your community. Where are those 15 things in the ban list, which ones are the most common items found on the ground here in your community? And can those be dealt with? Can the service be delivered a different way? Would restaurants maybe ask customers, do you want a plastic straw or not? How about a paper one instead? And the last thing, zero waste our government. My wife always says, campaign finance reform's got to happen. And she's right. And she's right. And I'll end on that slide. Thank you very much. We've got time for questions. Thank you.